You're in the Philosopher's Zone. Just you and me.
People are terrified of dealing with their own loneliness or thinking, or I guess admitting their own loneliness, and are in complete denial. People have this kind of reaction when I say I'm writing about loneliness. I don't even have to say anything about my own loneliness. I just say I'm writing about loneliness, and then there's this heavy silence.
Hello, I'm here, lonely, yeah.
Bertrand Russell once wrote that he sought love first because it brings ecstasy, and second because it relieves loneliness. Bertie was a clear-eyed, analytic philosopher, but he didn't mind speaking about such things. One of the few, as loneliness hasn't quite gained the kind of traction that, say, love has. It's a tough one to work out, as Diane Enns knows all too well. She's a philosopher by trade, and she'll need those tools and more to make sense of it all.
I lived through a particularly intense period of loneliness a few years back and started writing about my own experience. And then I started looking back over other times that I had experienced loneliness in my life and thought, okay, this is something worth pursuing. Of course, once I started, I realized what an enormous task it is, even just to start thinking about the actual experience of loneliness, because everyone has a very different experience of loneliness. Not that there aren't a few qualities about the experience that I think we could say are universal, but certainly when you start reading about loneliness in literature, in philosophy, in the social sciences, in psychology especially, you get a very different picture from a lot of scholars and a lot of people who have experienced it about what loneliness actually is. But I've been interested in community for a long time. And so when I started thinking about community, again, partly that's based on my own experience because I grew up in a very tight-knit religious community, which I left at the age of 20. And probably since then have been trying to find not something similar, because obviously I left for a good reason and didn't want to repeat that kind of close experience, which I think was somewhat claustrophobic and didn't really allow for a free-thinking person to think freely. But I know that it has been difficult for me personally to live without close ties. Both of these areas of research interest me quite a bit, and I'm partly that's based on personal experience, but partly just because I'm fascinated by the topic. We see loneliness everywhere, really.
It's very interesting because you say that when you wrote about love, everyone would sort of flutter their eyelids and say, well, that's a great thing to be writing about. But when you mentioned that you were working on a loneliness project, well, the response was very different.
Yes, everyone, I think, is afraid to talk about their own loneliness, afraid to admit it. But maybe it's a bigger fear than that as well. So I've been reading this psychiatrist, Frieda Fromm Reichman was her name. She was a 20th century psychiatrist who lived mostly in the U.S. And she wrote this essay on loneliness that was, I think, going to become a bigger work, but then she died. And so we have this short essay about it. And she says that people are terrified of dealing with their own loneliness or thinking, or I guess admitting their own loneliness, and are in complete denial. So yes, people have this kind of reaction when I say I'm writing about loneliness. I don't even have to say anything about my own loneliness. I just say I'm writing about loneliness, and then there's this heavy silence. I taught about it in a first year course a couple of weeks ago. In fact, I taught that essay by Frieda Fromm Reichman. And I just got the feeling that everyone was sort of uncomfortable with it. And my teaching assistants told me that their tutorials didn't really go all that well that week. And so, yeah, I think everyone is very much afraid of it. And now Fromm Reichman says it's because it has to do with our fear of death, because loneliness has something to do with death. We're afraid of the loneliness of death. I'm not so sure. I think partly the fear of loneliness has to do with being afraid to look as though you are unlovable, that nobody loves you, that you don't have enough friends. So nobody wants to admit that they're lonely. But it still doesn't make sense to me why people wouldn't want to talk about loneliness, even other people's loneliness. So I'm not sure. There's probably a lot of things to think about there.
Yeah. Talking about death, this probably takes us straight into the breadbasket of the existentialists, doesn't it? I mean, to continue that food metaphor, this is meat and potatoes for the existentialists. The idea of being in the world means to be with others.
What I see in the philosophers that I've looked at, there's, for example, in the existentialists, there's this emphasis on being alone, facing your responsibilities in life, creating meaning for your own life. And while I absolutely agree with the existentialist discussion of freedom and responsibility, at the same time, I don't think that that's really about loneliness. And loneliness for me is really an emotion. It's an intense craving for attachment. And yes, in existentialism, well, phenomenology especially, you have more of an acknowledgement of the need for attachment and bodily experience and closeness and all of that. But the philosophers tend to, obviously, there's a tendency to abstraction. And so sometimes I don't find them all that helpful in trying to understand actual experience. I'm really interested in the social and psychological experience of loneliness, because a lot of people are saying that loneliness is on the rise. We have a lot of popular writers now who are addressing this, like Susan Pinker in The Village Effect, or Sherry Turkle, who wrote a book called Alone Together. And I think it's partly because of the new technologies, new communication technologies that we have, but also because our community life is changing, our social life is changing, the family structure is changing. And for a lot of people, there's some nostalgia involved in this look at loneliness, because everything seemed great decades ago when people had families and communities to look after each other. But there's also a real fear of, I think, of what technology is doing to us. So those are some of the issues that I find more interesting than what we find in, for example, the existentialist concern with personal responsibility.
Interesting. You talked about the world as we find it now, that people are living alone more. The statistics bear that out across the Western nations in particular. And yet there is this potential counterforce of the digital network, the groups that come together because of their digital connection rather than their living side by side in bodily space connection. Is that the kind of thing you're trying to tease out, to work out?
Yes, because there are so many fascinating contradictions. Even just thinking about people who are living alone, for example. So I've looked at some statistics in Scandinavia, especially the single households are really growing. So something like 47 or 50%. I can't remember if this was in Sweden or the Netherlands, or maybe Denmark. Something like 50% of people live alone. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're lonely. And a lot of people have written about this move to living alone as a wonderful thing. It's liberating. It says something about our desires to be independent, and also says something about the changes in marriage and family life, of course, too. But I don't see those changes as negative necessarily. But because our society is very much structured around the nuclear family, just in terms of our living arrangements, our spatial arrangements, popular culture, everything is very much focused on the life of a couple. So to be single in that kind of society, I think, can be profoundly lonely. One of the things that I want to write about is my own decision to move from the city I work in to Toronto, a bigger city, because it's easier to be a single person. And I'm in my 50s, and some of my closest friends live in Toronto, and my son lives in Toronto. So I find it easier to be to have a life there than in a place where I have fewer friends. So as a single person, one has to find ways of living that we wouldn't ordinarily have to do if we were living within a family or have a significant relationship, a romantic partner, let's say. It shouldn't be that way, in my view. It shouldn't be that the only way we can escape loneliness is to be in a romantic couple relationship. And that, I think, is unfortunate. And I think a lot of people are finding this is one of the main reasons why there's more loneliness.
There is that, people say that you can be alone in a crowd. You're talking about being close to people and not necessarily in a romantic situation. And yet people can live side by side for years and not really engage authentically and be lonely in their own way.
Yes, and I mean, there's a lot of contradictions there too. So why I find it easier to be in a bigger city is partly because there are more spaces, more public places for me to be in. So for example, I do a lot of my work in cafes, and one of the things I want to write about in this project is some of the interactions that happen in cafes. So there's one in particular I'm thinking of where at a certain time in the morning, the families start coming in, and the children in this cafe tend to bring everyone together. So strangers start talking to each other. Even the configuration of the tables, I don't know if it's like this now in Australia, but in cafes here now, we're starting to have longer tables so that everyone is forced to sit with other people. So those of us with our annoying laptops can't just take up a table by ourselves. And it does lead to conversations. I have met people through cafes that aren't necessarily my best friends now, but we need to have we have a variety of social needs that are met in different ways. So I think a neighborhood is crucial. Just that feeling that you belong to this neighborhood and you actually have neighbors that you can talk to. Neighbors who you may only see when you're out shoveling snow in the winter or cutting grass in the summer. I mean, I think loneliness is in the first place about a craving for attachment, but it can be alleviated by these looser social networks. So being in a cafe where you meet the same people, where little children come in and get you talking to each other, or meeting people in your neighborhood, that I think is absolutely crucial for making people feel less lonely. And that I think is what we often lose because of our connectivity. And I do think that technology, again, very contradictory, because I think of so many people who are less lonely because they have email or they can text family members, for example, elderly people. My mother, I know she loves to text her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren even. So this can make us feel more connected. But at the same time, it is also, I think, preventing us from more face-to-face interaction. And that, I think, we need to do something about it.
You would make a claim that being in the same space is important to the whole thing of kind of defeating deep-set loneliness.
I don't think anyone gets all of their social needs or their needs for attachment met through one person. Yes, we do need neighborhoods. Yes, we do need to have bodily interactions with other people, for sure. I think it's essential. I mean, I've had conversations with students about this who are much less, let's say, pessimistic about where social media is taking us. But I already felt quite surprised at how they perceived what a community was with how I perceived what a community was. So for me, to have friends and a community, if you want to call it that, or looser bonds, means that you have people who are willing to help you physically or materially when you need something. For them, I don't think it was so much about that. I just remember this one discussion with a student who insisted that his gaming community was actually a community. And when I suggested that there was a qualitative difference between his gaming community, where they never met each other, and a community where you are actually able to help someone, bring them food when they're grieving a loss, or helping them cut their lawn or something. He quite objected to my suggestion that there was a qualitative difference here. So I think already there is a loss. And I understand that when I say that to my students especially, they think, oh, I'm just an old person who's who's nostalgic for the old days. But I don't think I am, because I recognize also the real problems of a community that's enclosed, that's too closed. So I think it's mostly just about the need for a whole bunch of different social relationships, and they go by degree from intensity to looser, as weak bonds, as you said.
In the Philosopher's Zone, Diane ends on something we don't like to talk about all that much.
If I could take you back to the existentialists, and I know you don't want to necessarily follow that as your kind of groundwork, but the way we're talking about loneliness here is in the everyday setting, and it can come in grades. You can even probably get rid of it for a while. But in that greater existential backdrop, the idea, I guess, is that loneliness is always there, because that is the nature of being in the world with others.
Well, I think that we could make two different arguments here, and actually people do. So on the one hand, there are some who say, and I believe Kierkegaard said this, that loneliness is essential to human existence. But there are others who say, well, togetherness is also essential to human existence. So whether it's one or the other, well, I think that probably everybody has an experience of loneliness at some point. But to say that it's the essence of human life or something essential like that, I wouldn't want to say that, because I think it's actually the opposite. I think that we are, right from our time in the womb, we are not alone. And if we are lonely, I think that's something negative. It isn't something positive. If we are lonely, it's because we are not getting enough of the attachment that we crave, or the closeness that we crave with other human beings. That, I think, is a sad statement. Either it's about social conditions, or it could be mental illness can cause extreme loneliness. So I'm not one of those people who would say, well, this is our existential condition, and this is the way we can find the truth about ourselves. I've read some accounts by philosophers or religious thinkers, like Thomas Merton, I think, was one of them, who said this is how we find the truth of ourselves, that we have to experience loneliness. Now, I do think that solitude is necessary, especially for creative people, especially for thinking people. I mean, I could not do my work without solitude, but I don't think solitude and loneliness are the same at all. Loneliness is a really painful experience. Solitude can be delicious. I mean, we can crave solitude as much as we can crave being with other people.
I'm glad you mentioned the S word, solitude, because I find myself that if I'm with groups of people for too long and there's too much going on, it could be a big party or whatever, I'll need a day the day after as a way of just getting over it and clearing it through my head. And I guess if you are a, if you're that kind of person, it's an interesting balance between the two.
But that's what's so bizarre, is that people have such a different balance there. I mean, I've read Sarah Maitland, who's a Scottish writer who lives in the middle of nowhere and wrote this book called How to Be Alone. And it's like a self-help book about how to be alone. And she says she only meets, oh, some farmer going by on a quad every few weeks, and I suppose the postal carrier once in a while, and she has family she calls, but she could go for weeks without seeing anyone, and she seems completely happy with this. In fact, she advocates that people should be alone, they should teach their children how to be alone, they should travel alone. So everyone has a very different balance here, and I think the problem is when those who love solitude tell others that they should love solitude, and those who love being with someone all the time and hate being alone try to tell others that they shouldn't be alone. I think there's a real difference here in terms of what people can handle. How long can you be alone before you go crazy?
It does come down to temperament to some degree, I think. You mentioned religion before and your connection to religion, and there's that often discussed spiritual element to the idea of loneliness, that you've got to go through the dark night of the soul to get to something better. I guess that is connected to the existential discussion we were having before and Kierkegaard. Clearly that's something you reject, and you don't accept that that would be the way loneliness operates.
Religion is interesting in a discussion of loneliness because it is one of those ways that people can flee loneliness. So I was just looking up Kierkegaard recently. I have not systematically looked at his work on loneliness, but when he talks about having this a relationship with God or having needing faith, I think, well, yes, of course, that helps us, anyone, feel less lonely because there is intimacy there. There's intimacy with a God. So one of the questions I have in thinking about my own experience of loneliness is how much of it relies, or how much of it is the result of having lost God when I was 20 or 21, because that relationship, and I think whether you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish or any religion, for many people, that central relationship to a God is probably, could be described as one of the most intimate relationships they have. So I think having faith in a God, having a what someone might call a personal relationship with a spiritual being could be one of the best ways to escape loneliness, because someone is there who always loves you. Someone loves you unconditionally. You communicate with this person. So I've written about how until I was 20, I shared everything in my life with God and my dog and my high school boyfriend. So they were all in a way equal. It's having a primary interlocutor, having someone to share everything with. So I think that, but does that, I don't know, in terms of the dark night of the soul, I'm not really sure how to answer that. I think religion can help people feel less lonely.
This project comes off the back of a work on love, your work on love, Love in the Dark, where I think you also discuss loss and other aspects of it. Is this a natural step from there? I mean, did that make you think of loneliness as another project?
Yes, well, that book was also written after a particular experience of love for a very destructive person. And after I left that person, yes, I experienced probably what I would say is the greatest period of loneliness in my life. And I went overseas to Berlin for 2 months, partly to make sure I did not return to this relationship. And it was really, really difficult to be in a foreign country where I didn't know anyone, all by myself, experiencing grief as well. That was when I started writing about loneliness, but also about what became that book, Love in the Dark. One of the things that I would like to point out is that despite the loneliness, I chose it. And I think many people would say this about loneliness. If they decide to leave a bad relationship, they probably know they're going to be lonely. But there are worse things than loneliness. So I would say this too about some of the people who choose to live alone. They may know that they're facing loneliness, but there are worse things. But yes, I mean, loneliness often follows leaving relationship. So it kind of makes sense.
Hello, I'm here.
Diane Enns, Associate Professor of Philosophy at McMaster University in Canada. She's previously written about victimhood, political freedom, and love, and now onto loneliness. Thanks today to Diane Dean. I'm Joe Gelonesi, and you've been in the Philosopher's Zone.
It's science.
For me as a scientist.
It's culture.
Imagine.
And everything in between.
Do you know what this means?
Natasha Mitchell here. Join me for season one of Science Friction. From radioactive Boy Scouts to self-experimentation. All species welcome Science Friction. Listen via the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.